Oh boy, is that a joyful noise indeed. That's South Africa's West Nkosi on Penny Whistle with Mazuzu, meaning young woman. Obviously, he was referring to me. This is from his critically acclaimed 1993 album, Rhythm of Healing. Nkosi was a music producer, producing for many of South Africa's top performers and bands. He died in 1998 from injuries sustained in an auto accident. He was 58 years old. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it's Free Your Mind Friday. No bows, no tinsel, no fancy wrapping here, just plain, unvarnished truth. And you're cordially invited to our weekly celebration of information, opinions, and ideas. Call 888-874-4888 to join the festivities. Well, of course, let me start off by letting you know that on Monday, because Christmas is on a Sunday, I've been told that the station is going to be doing some special programming. So I probably, in fact, more than likely, I will not be live on Monday, but a rerun of a program, a previous program, will be run again on Monday. So we'll see each other literally in real time on Tuesday instead. Okay, so just remember that. I'll do a remind at the end of the program today. 888-874-4888. A lot of ground to cover this week. A lot of stuff happened this week. It happens every week. But you are certainly welcome to comment on the issues of the day that we touched on this week. And you're welcome also to speak your mind about any topic that you wish. Leah from Brooklyn, we'll start with you today.
How are you, Eutrice?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm wishing that the Creator will continue to bless you with health and wealth and peace and power.
Ooh, and that's a long list, but it's a great list. I'll take it.
Yes, and extend my holiday wishes to the entire PRN family and a special shout-out to Sarah out in Dallas. But I would like to free my mind on a particular subject, and it's revisionist history. On Wednesday morning, I listened to a small clip of Ann Tripp on WBLF as she was recounting the events of the day before, the 30th anniversary of the Howard Beach incident. And she started to give a list of the notables who attended the event. And the first name that she said was Attorney at War C. Vernon Mason. After she said that, I heard nothing else, because we all know that the real Attorney at War is Alton H. Maddox, Jr.
No question.
I was so peeved about that. In addition to that, the week before on Reverend Sharpton's radio program, the Saturday morning program, he started telling everyone that there was going to be a celebration and started saying that the National Action Network and others initiated the march in Howard Beach. Now, we all know that that's not true, but everything that was said about that 30th anniversary celebration, Reverend Sharpton is taking credit for it. And I think that, you know, anybody in the WBLS listening area needs to put Ann Tripp and WBLS on blast for having, you know, made that egregious error. And now my mind is free. I said I have to call in today.
Well, this is why the program exists, so that you can free your mind and ours too. Indeed, Attorney at War, and that is my own moniker for Attorney at War Alton Maddox. And
yes.
I so admire and respect him, because he deserves that title, you know, because it's not just an honorific title. It is an actual title This man has been in the service of the community in the capacity of the People's Attorney General for so many years.
Exactly.
And has never charged a penny. As far as I know, in the cases that I've covered, he has never charged a penny and yet has won these cases, including cases against Sharpton himself. So
I think it's a total disgrace that people do that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah, they're trying to write him out of history. It's a disgrace.
It's more than a disgrace. It's just people the ability to nonchalantly do it when they ought to know better. I'm a bit surprised at this, because this is really not the case at all. I was there, and I know it. I know exactly how that case came about and all things associated with that case. Howard Beach.
Yes.
No. We know who the key actor there was. We know.
Absolutely.
Thanks for correcting the record.
It reminds me of a program that used to come on in the 50s. I think it was What's My Line? You know, will the real, you know, whomsoever, please stand up, you know?
Please stand up.
Yeah.
Well, so you corrected the record. I'm glad that you did that. Thank you so much. From Chicago, Henry, what's happening in your neck of the woods?
Hey, you trees, how's it going?
I'm okay. I'm hanging in.
All right. I want to wish greetings to you and the other PRN listeners. Also to, whatever holidays you celebrate. Best wishes.
Thank you so much for that. That was very nice of you.
So I wanted to comment about what was on your show yesterday about the press conference that the New Orleans mayor did with the victims of the bridge incident. Now, it's so funny because when I initially started listening to like the first minute or so, I'm thinking he's going to talk about the victims of the Hurricane Katrina incident that happened.
I was hoping to hear something about that, but go ahead.
But that was, that was initially my first thought. Then he started saying stuff like man-made incident. And I'm like, man-made? I'm like, Hurricane Katrina wasn't man-made. And so when he started going on, he started talking about the bridge and New Orleans police, basically murdering, And then it popped in my head. I was like, oh, he's talking about the bridge incident. Okay. So he was very, very cloudy on, when he first initially started saying it. So that actually raised my antennas right there about what his motive and what his purpose was on how he was going to communicate this whole incident. So, and then you started talking about the forgiveness part, because, it did make me very queasy when, you started hearing about the victims talk about forgiveness. And the one thing that I always listen about when you hear about these things about forgiveness, because you heard about it in the Dylann Roof case where I think one or two families of the victim of the Dylann Roof murder came up and forgive him. And the media like paraded that like it was like to no end. However, they didn't say that the other families forgive Dylann Roof. They just paraded those one or two families who did that. But then I also asked myself this question, like, so how many families forgave the Boston bomber people? How many families forgave the people who, who caused the 9/11 attacks? You want to ask forgiveness from the victims of black families, but how about those people who were more affected, in these terrorist attacks? Do you forgive the terrorists? So forgiveness it has become a political tool, within the media and within within the system itself, because they want to play upon our, quote unquote, moral emotions, which is, nothing moral about it at all. But, it's like, I feel you when you talked about the forgiveness part, because I'm like, I think there was only one family that forgave the Boston Bombers. All those other families was like, listen, this dude needs to die. This dude needs to, there needs to be justice had. So I'm not understanding this forgiveness thing as well.
I understand it perfectly. I mean, and I think you do too. The idea of the city, the mayor of the city, saying that he actually put it in the context of a kind of requirement to close, to truly close the book on this, what he called this incident. What would be required is for the city to say, we're sorry. And so he said, we're sorry. Okay, well, that's done. But that doesn't take any effort, really, to say you're sorry. He says, we're sorry. And to show how sorry we are, we're willing to give these 17 families $13.3 million. Now, what we require in return, we require it. You know, this is not a kind of optional thing, is that for the families to say, well, we forgive you. No, that's not the way it works. You can't tell people and order people to forgive you. But that is in line with the old idea that all black folks are just church people. And they're deeply spiritual, and that's where you can find them. You can find all black people. That's where all the candidates find them during the election process. They go to a church, and therefore you have reached all of black America. But it is more than that, because it is also an indication that they don't expect, we shouldn't expect any of this to be genuine, because it is part of the settlement process, in a way, because the city is saying, we're sorry, we own up to it, we fess up, and here's some money, and this is what we'll do. Of course, the money is not at all appropriate, the appropriate amount that should be paid, given, I mean, you had a cop that killed a man and then burned him to ashes in the backseat of a car. This is a level of violence that, I mean, you can't imagine that normal people would do this. And if there are elements within the police department that will do something like that, get away with it, have it covered up, it means that the whole, you know, that mentality has infected the whole department. So part of settlement is, on the part of the family, they have to hold the city harmless in order to get the money. Yeah, the injury that's done to them already is not even all of it. The injury is underscored by this legal requirement. They generally have to sign papers and whatnot, that in accepting this settlement money, they will no longer hold the city or the agents of the city, meaning the police officers, accountable. This is what infuriated me with the Michael Brown case, with the Eric Garner case. I am totally outraged. No lawyer should go into settlement. It's not about settlement. Settlement is not justice.
No, yeah, you're right. And this case reminded me so much of a case here in Chicago, the John Birch torture case as well. And it's like the same. It's almost like the same thing in another city, you know.
This is part of the playbook. This is, remember, everything is a system. This is a national system in dealing with legitimate cases. When people are seeking justice for the wrongful acts of police in their various cities, this is the playbook. This is how they do it.
And what's so terrible about this, you, Teresa, and I'm going to add this before I close. Speaking of the John Birch case,
You know, they did prosecute John Birch. However, the top guy during that time, Mayor Richard Daley, who still hasn't been prosecuted yet, was honored at a ward here in Chicago where predominantly black people sit at. Honored. And the people, the victims in the John Birch case were majority African American. Why are you honoring this man?
Who controls the police department in Chicago?
Huh?
Who controls the police department in Chicago?
Oh, it's not us. I tell you that.
Okay. Chicago, like New York City and many other cities, Chicago's police department and other related departments like the fire department and so forth, and it's the race rule. The Irish had the fire department, the Irish had the police department, like in New York City, the Italians had the sanitation department, Jews had the Department of Education. This is how they divvied it up. So if you have an Irish mayor whose father also dominated politics in Chicago, you can't talk about Chicago politics unless the name Daley comes up. They rule the police department. They cover for each other. The Garner case, you have the chief person, although it should be the whole group that was there, that should have been indicted and prosecuted, because even the medical personnel were negligent and refused really to offer the aid to Eric Garner that he desperately needed at the time that they came upon the scene. But the chief person that they blamed for applying the chokehold, this is Officer Pantaleo, he's Italian. And you have the Irish element coming in, bolstering the Italian element, mm-hmm. because the victim is black, and nobody cares. So
yeah, you're right.
this is the makeup in most metropolitan areas. You can see how these different departments are separated and ruled by racial fiat almost. Thanks, Henry. Great to hear from you. Paul from Maryland, you're on the air.
Hi. I had a question regarding the outgoing presidency. One thing that came up mainly before the election was a phrase that I kept hearing called President Obama being a creature of the Clintons. And I wanted to just get some clarity about what that meant. What was their prior relationship even before he took office back in 08. Thank you.
Well, I regularly refer to President Obama myself as a creature of the Clinton political dynasty. Hillary Clinton comes out of Chicago, as does Barack Obama. And although, of course, you know, being Secretary of State and being the First Lady and so forth, a lot of it transferred to Washington, D.C., but the root of her real political power isn't even in Arkansas, where Bill Clinton was both Attorney General and Governor. But the reason we look, I just talked with Henry about the Irish connection, and that was part of the connection that Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton were part of. They dominated, they were very much entrenched in the Daley political machine, and Chicago politics, like New York politics, is notoriously corrupt. But this is how it works. In Baltimore, for example, you have the same dynamic, that if you're going to rise through the ranks of politics, you need a godfather. Very seldom a godmother, but mostly a godfather. And that comes out of the machine. You have a Democratic machine in Chicago that is legendary and legendarily very, very corrupt. But that was what gave the Clintons a special edge. And they have kept the Chicago roots as their political base, really. And, of course, New York. But Chicago was where they kind of were groomed and got to appreciate, because they were very much involved in Chicago politics, though not overtly, but they benefited a lot from the Chicago Democratic machine and learned the ins and outs of politics in Chicago, not Arkansas, not New York City, but Chicago. Barack Obama came upon the scene and was being groomed for leadership of some sort. I don't think they actually expected him to be pursuing the presidency, but I think they looked at him as, well, you know, he's a nice, sharp-looking guy, graduate from Harvard, and he was involved in community organizing. He had begun to show some ability as a state senator in Chicago, and he was working up to something, surely. There was nobody in Chicago, black, with the power to groom him and pull him up the ranks. Nobody. Chicago did not have that kind of black democratic organization. It was fully dominated by the Dailies and their minions. And so to succeed in Chicago, if you were an African-American person, to a certain degree, they liked that. They would be able to point to the difference between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, in that the Democratic Party offers opportunities for bright young people. And so they groomed him. They helped him up. Other people groomed him as well, thinking that his interest was really to help African-Americans, people like Jeremiah Wright, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, and other community types who saw potential in him as well. But he was a capture. He was a capture for the Democrats. And then when he spoke at the Democratic National Convention and just electrified the air, that was a signal that, yeah, this guy's going all the way. He's going all the way. But hopefully he will have the decency and loyalty to go all the way after Hillary Clinton. But he didn't observe those rules, because the faction, election experts who came to him, I'm talking about Plouffe and Evzeroff. What's his name? Not Evzeroff. I'll remember in a minute. You see him on TV all the time. Who had advised previous candidates decided to go with him and groom him into the fine art of electioneering. And they also used it as a learning experience, because they contrived a very atypical method of raising money, of organizing troops, and of assuring him, even if the Clinton forces were apt to interfere with his ascendancy, they had organized an unusual and spectacularly successful machine that could resist any attempts at all on any level to forestall his ascendancy. And in fact, he won the election. But there's no question that he's a creature. He's been created in part. This is not to say that he has no gifts or powers of his own. He does. But this was also his first shot at national politics at which he really knew very little. He knew very little. So for the Clintons, they could still claim some degree of credit for grooming him for the presidency, and at the same time seek to control him. It's a very delicate balance.
Well, that's very interesting, because it almost begs the question, was the competition during that primary between Obama and Clinton for the Democratic nomination back in 08, was that even legit?
I think it was, because I think the expectation was that he would behave himself and make himself subservient to Clinton. That was the first real indication that he made that he was not going to submit totally to the Clintons, that he had a good thing going, and so he'll just keep going. And of course, all the polls and whatnot showed that between Hillary and Obama, Obama beat her in every category: more popular, more approachable, more credible, etc. Hillary was still, back then, not trustworthy, and she just did not enjoy the level of popularity that Obama had at the time.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Well, I guess my only parting question is that now, post-electoral college vote, has she gone away this time for good?
No, that's not her character at all. It's not her character. She's going to be around for a while. But I'm pretty sure that it will happen very soon, something would actually totally disable her, and she will have to withdraw. It's not going to be easy for her, given her personality. But she's going to be forced to withdraw, because she's on her way to becoming, and I think, I wouldn't say on her way, she is now, viewed even within the party as a liability. And the party has to always weigh this business of, well, are we a cult of personality party, or are we taking care of the business of the party and not letting one person drag the whole party down? This was the message that we got by even going after Bernie Sanders, who Hillary had captured, because that was the implication there. Her credibility rating was so low. The party needs help. The party has suffered several lethal blows. And she, Hillary Clinton, is at the center of all of this. The party is literally dying on its feet. And it has come to realize and recognize that. And they're making a strong effort to kind of revive the party, but I don't know that they can, because people are so turned off. They're disgusted with the Democratic Party. And she is a main reason that they are disgusted with the party. Thanks for calling in. Well, look who is here. It says Sarah. I can't believe my eyes.
Latrice, how are you? Greetings to you.
Thank you. Same with you. How are you, Sarah?
Well, Latrice, I am doing as well as can be expected, because I guess you left New York and you send the cold storm coming up my way here, because it's kind of misting out here and it's cold. We were running in the 20s and the 30s, so I thought I was back on the East Coast a few days this week. But I'm glad you all bundled up and nicely and snugged in Florida, so I'm not going to envy you that, you know, having that good weather down there.
Well, we have good weather, yes. So I'm yes, looking at it through so far for the day. The sun has been out and it looks beautiful outside.
Well, I'm jealous because it's gray, overcast, and misting.
So on what are you opining today?
Well, what I was going to touch on is the previous caller, and Henry, nice to hear him from Chicago. What I was talking about, the last caller that spoke about with the Clintons and whether or not they're going to go away, whether you thought it was all staged. My opinion is I believe this was all staged because these candidates are selected at least 3 to 4 years in advance, and everybody is given their prop and their position on this global stage and told what roles they're going to be played. And my whole thing is that the same like with Donald Trump and all of them is Barack Obama had to be used after George Bush because of what was planned on a global scale that was not going to be accomplished with a Hillary Clinton and her somewhat, you know, brusque way of doing business. She didn't have that smiling, you know, approachable personality, and that is why they picked him. And then plus what they had planned for Africa and the Middle East, they had to have someone of a Barack Obama personality who have ties to both part of that of those continents, one by way of his father and the way by his stepfather and his mother with Indonesia and with Islam. He was going to be used as that antidote within which to suppress resistance and to give you this false sense of comfort that you were indeed going to be giving some change and that things were going to be smoothed out that George Bush had messed up. And as we can see, for the past 8 years or so, the protest movement died. Black people became comfortable because they were so enamored with the brown smiling face, the charming brown wife and mother-in-law and two daughters that were occupying this White House. But they lost sight of the fact that these people are just placeholders and they have been used because we have always let symbols be used against us. And as you have stated with these families of these police murders and terroristic attacks, how they have always been used to come out here and to quell any sort of uprising by talking this forgiveness nonsense and about, you know, when forgiveness should be the very last thing on any menu. Forgiveness normally is a process that you have to work through. It's not something that you come to immediately because that's not part of the grieving stage. It's the very last stage that you would come to after you come to acceptance of your loss and everything else, and then you would start the forgiveness process. But what has been put upon us as a people is that we must accept this brutality, which is why you are seeing it being publicized on a much larger scale, and you're seeing this continuous rerunning of the brutality of the Eric Garners and the Michael Brown. They show you films over and over again of these men being assaulted. You don't see the same thing with Reginald Denny, the white truck driver who was assaulted after the Rodney King situation in L.A. You didn't see they're doing those repeated things of Reginald Denny. But when it comes to black bodies being brutalized on a global scale, they're going to show it continues. They'll keep looping it over and over again because, one, you're getting two things out of it. One thing is you get to anesthetize the community to normalize and to accept the brutality of yourself. And then, of course, you empower the groups out here who see us as easy targets for them to come in and to do these things to us and to get away with it, which is why you're seeing, you know, and we have been reduced to such a stage now where a lot of us want to do is pull out our cell phones and film. Nobody wants to get in and stop things from happening, but we want to become like, you know, inactive participants in what we see happening around us. And this is a situation that has, you know, it has me totally in a flux to see what the heck is going on with us as a people. Because we have totally... It seems to me that we have totally given in and allowed these things, this brutality to happen. And a lot of us have accepted as a norm, as you said, you know, we go for these settlements. And of course, with these settlements comes the check. And of course, that you cannot say anything against the police department or against law enforcement because as a condition of you receiving these big payouts. And that should be the last thing that should be on anybody's mind, because if the first thing that you want, if you want justice, you know, you're not going to get justice with a check. Money can always be devalued. Money is something that the people who have this money in place with their pictures on these bills, they set the currency rate, and money is, as I said, it's a debt tool that is based on you, the value that you placed in it. And if tomorrow they get up and they say a dollar is worth a dime, and you need to get 100 of these in order to add up to $1, then, you know, that's what it is. And we have got to come out of this system, you treat, which is why I've said over and over again, people get on me. I see voting is not something that's going to solve our situation. It's a passive tool that was given to us, and a lot of us have accepted it as it being that the primary tool, the primary function that we can use to resolve our situation. We didn't use a ballast within which to find ourselves in the bottom of slave ships. The people who came along and brutalized and decimated our community, they didn't use a balloting process. They sat around, they strategized, they planned, and of course, they used weapons as their means to enforce it. And for us to use voting and as well as depending on the court system, it is idiotic. Because laws are personal opinions backed up with the force of a gun. That's what a law is. And these people have shown you over and over again, and they go around the globe, and it's their personal opinion that we're going to come in here, we're going to take your resources, we're going to oppress you, and we have weapons within which to back up the opinions that we're coming with, and you can't do nothing. You better get some bigger weapons or whatever to stand up against us to say our opinion or our laws is not what it's going to be.
I have a slightly different view about the Clinton-Obama thing. And it is, in a way, I don't know if it's true or not, but I just get this hint, I've gotten it a while ago, that there might have been a small rebellion going on there between the Obama forces and the Clinton forces. Mm-hmm. And the Obama forces made the case, because by then the Democrats were getting, you know, a little bit antsy, and Hillary was barking for this thing. She was so set on being president. But the technocrats, the people who were able to deliver the goods, sided with Obama and left her basically without the ability to pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
They looked at Obama as, hey, an exciting, not because they believed in him or anything like that. It's just that it was an exciting proposition to them because they would get to do new things and they could pull it off. As you see, after the election, they now, you know, in business for themselves. They're consulting with heads of state or people who want to be heads of state all around the world. They launched their business on the strength of the Obama campaign. So I think at one time when it was possible, they could have gone with Hillary Clinton, but they would never have profited as much as the technocrats, the people who are actually running and planning, they hadn't done that with a new twist, and they hadn't learned about this. Don't forget, the one thing that Obama's candidacy did was precisely that, revolutionize politics. I mean, electioneering. He created, mm-hmm. his candidacy created a whole new approach. And they got a very good start. They didn't have to spend their own money to do their own research. They had people going and knocking on doors and collecting data and information and so forth. So they got a lot of free stuff that would cost them billions of dollars if they had to start it themselves. They were less intrigued about the prospect of, say, electing or helping Hillary Clinton get elected, but they saw greater promise on the far end by going with Obama, that he was a far more exciting candidate because of that. He was black, so they made history, and they can now credit themselves as the people who brought into being the first black president of the United States. That's cash. That's money in their world.
They not got only that, you three.
Huh?
But not only that, that they got a cachet of, you know, pluses and bonuses with him.
Lots of information. But I think that's what happened. I think that's what happened. They would have gone with Hillary if her would-be opponent was just run-of-the-mill. But Barack Obama's candidacy was exciting, and it promised a big yield on the other side, because it spawned them as leaders of this new industry. And they're still making money off of that campaign. And they still have a lot of information that many research outfits don't have. And they got it for free. So, you know, all these things you have to take into consideration. It's so good hearing from you today, Sarah. I'm glad.
If I could say this really, really quickly, and I'll get off the line. That might be so, all of this is the above that you mentioned, it's so, but we've got to take into fact that Hillary Clinton would have been a repeat of George Bush in a pantsuit that they did not want. They had to get more or less a softer, gentler approach within which to go into Africa, move AFRICOM, and, you know, recolonize it under this black person. Because as you can see, all of the African nations, they did not give any resistance to him. If a Hillary Clinton, like a George Bush, would have come in, it would have been more of a resistance the same way it did across Asia. So he was as Glenn Ford and them, like a black agenda report, like you say, he was the necessary evil that was used within which to get these things accomplished.
But the record also shows that didn't happen either. He was not that successful. And there has not been much of a success with foreign policy in Africa at all. In fact, he ignored Africa quite a lot and the Caribbean. He just didn't pay attention. So if the hope was that, through Obama, we'll get all this stuff. Look, they could get all the stuff at any time. The hope was that with Obama, you'd get a far more sensible approach, a far more sympathetic ear, but that didn't happen at all. Thanks, and I'm so glad to hear from you.
You're welcome, you three.
Thank you. Well, let's see who's next. I think it's Eric from Brooklyn.
Hello.
Hello, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to make comments about what you played yesterday about New Orleans, and it's a different perspective about the faith aspect. You know, I think that because of our history, because of our brutalization in this part of the world, and the way we got here, faith has become a kind of weapon against us, because it's used in a way where it's a trade-off. You know, they can take everything from you, right? And faith is the last thing you can go to your grave with. So we'll give you that. And it's a disgusting display, and it really disturbs me when you see all of these so-called faith leaders participating in this charade, where, you know, you negate everything that people need to live. You actually can kill them, and they're kind of the kind of solution, or the kind of, you know, I can't get the word.
But we're getting the idea.
You know,
getting your idea.
You know, the solace that they can take away from these incidents is this idea of faith. You know, it really disgusts me. Another thing that I wanted to address is something that I hear all the time. And this is this idea of what Roosevelt said, you know, when he said, when you know, the activists went to him and he said, yeah, I agree, and go out and make me do it. And people keep repeating it about Obama. And this is this, we always warned, we've been warned against accepting, you know, becoming adjusted to injustice. And this is another display of it. You know, you have these people spending billions of dollars telling you that they're the solution. They tell you chapter and verse about the problems that they're going to really work hard towards. You know, you go for them, you vote for them, and then they come on the scene. And, you know, as soon as they get the job, then they turn around and say, you got to make me do it now. You know, like what kind of person, what kind of boss would hire an employee and the employee gives a resume and says, yeah, I'm qualified and I'm going to do this job and I'm going to do it well, blah, blah, blah. And then he gets a job and gets to tell the boss, which is the people who voted, he gets to tell the boss that now you go out and make me do the job that you just gave me. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, so actually, it does. It makes a lot of sense. And I'll tell you why.
Okay.
In politics, the leader can do a lot of things. However, the leader will also have to deal with the fact that a lot of opposition is coming against him. He cannot do certain things, or she, alone. And what was meant by that phrase of go out and make me do it was, and I think you're right about that too, the idea that people just get into office and then all bets are off. But there's another side to be appreciated here, and that is that the communities take the position that once they contribute to the election of a person, that's the job.
Mm-hmm.
And they check out. And it is very helpful to a leader to demonstrate that whatever it is that is being pursued as part of the agenda of the same groups that elected them, that they have a continuing interest in it and they're prepared to fight for it. Now, you can't dismiss that as being unimportant. The pattern has been the people elect or they contribute to the election in a key way. Like, for example, African Americans contributed hugely to the election of Barack Obama. And then they just left it there. They backed away. They never put the fire under his butt. They never disagreed with him openly or criticized him openly. They never held his feet to the fire. They just said, we elected you. Now you know what you got to do. No, the fight isn't over. The fight is an ongoing fight. Okay, what's the but?
The but is that there's, I mean, you know, you look at cases like the demonstration Gary Noe had, you know, in D.C. about GMOs, right? I went to that demonstration. Me and my family, my wife and kids, we went there, right? So you have these big demonstrations. You have Occupy Wall Street. You have demonstrations against the wars, against the pipelines. But where are we in that regard? The Michael Taylor, one of the head attorneys for Monsanto, becomes the head of the FDA. So the betrayal, the complete betrayal, is something that people have to observe also. And that's the neglect. We neglect to observe those huge betrayals. People are demonstrating against the pipeline. How many pipelines have been built?
You know you went straight to my heart with this point. Because one of the things I said, going back to Jesse Jackson, the first order of business is to cancel his contract, or what he thinks is his contract. The first order of business with Bernie Sanders is to publicly fire him.
This is my point. This is my biggest point. People have to come off of this idea that, nobody protested anything. Nobody tried. How can you? You can't light a fire under somebody's butt when they refuse to move. When they do opposite.
Oh, yes, you can. You can.
When they do the opposite.
I'll tell you, there's so many points that would illustrate the exact opposite of that. There are constituencies in the United States that are devoted year-round. The only thing that, let's take AIPAC, the American-Israel Political Action Committee, right? Mm-hmm. That's all they do. It's about Israel. And Israel is always right. And whatever Israel needs, their job is to make sure that this government provides it. And it does. Whether there's an election year or whether it's an off year, it doesn't matter. That's all they do is lobby. Where are these lobby groups for African Americans and Latinos and so forth that are not just being ceremonial, but are mm-hmm. kicking some butt? There's an agenda. And people are just disregarding the agenda. Every year, the Congressional Black Caucus has its annual convention. Okay. So you have a convention. What is coming out of it? You invite the president every single year. He is the keynote speaker. Mm-hmm. And you can't point to, you can't have him answer the question, what the heck's going on with Detroit? How come you're not revitalizing Detroit? How come your education secretary is shutting down schools in Detroit and in Philadelphia and in Baltimore? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, it's a social event.
Is that because there's been no activism to that regard?
Oh, no, that's not true. I'll even go so far as to say, let's say there's absolutely no activism other than the Congressional Black Caucus. What, does it need people to kick its butt so that it could kick the president's butt? No. The reason you're in business as a lobbying organization, eventually, is that you take on that responsibility. Every year, the Urban League puts out its State of Black America. I'm sick of it.
Their only interest is to take on the money in their pockets. They're not interested in resolving any black issues.
But who's calling them out? Who's calling them out on this?
Utrice, and this is what I'm saying. I think
I get what you're saying. I do not disagree with you at all on what you're saying. You're absolutely correct. I'm saying
we've got to stop giving these people so much of benefit of the doubt so that we make these excuses for them when they produce nothing. We keep saying that, it's because we're not going out there and demonstrating a lot. No, at a point, psychologically, people get discouraged. You know, when you have so many times that, you know, people go out there, they demonstrate. Okay, eventually, you know, and this is a sad thing. But eventually people are going to say, you know, if there's absolutely nothing else to look forward to, if we go out and we demonstrate for a month, we don't have the capacity, for the most part, to go out and be lobbying every day and blah, blah, blah. No. You demonstrate, you have an incident, somebody gets shot. You demonstrate for a while, but you still got to live, you know? So then these people come and they offer you money. It's always the faith people. It's always some top politician in the area or some top cop. They come on and say, listen, you can either get nothing or you can get a little bit of money and go away quietly. You know, these people keep taking the money. But it's also a product of this idea that the people you're putting into place, the people that you're rooting for in your community who are doing absolutely nothing, continue to get your benefit of the doubt that, if we were to push them a little harder, they might do more. No, they refuse to do it. And at certain point,
you have a circle of blame here. This is what is going on. The lawyers themselves are not interested in taking on what will be a brutal fight with the system to get justice.
But Utrice, can I ask you something?
Sure.
Mike, you know, I have a position. My position is that there's no law. There's no law here. The law is arbitrary, and it's something that people pick and choose. You know, yeah, you can rape kids or you can rape a 15-year-old, and it's a bunch of cops. Well, is that legal? No, it's not legal. Will they get away with it? Yes, they'll get away with it.
Yes.
It's all based on what they feel like doing it because they're empowered. So this
they're empowered, but you also have to recognize while your points are very strong and hard to argue against them, we always have to keep in mind that life is a dynamic situation. Things change. And we cannot just hold on to the old ways of doing things in the 60s when things have changed. So we have to change our tactics. That's what we have to work on. We have to work on developing dynamic approaches to our problems. And at least then we would get some measure of relief. But we can't just say, well, we marched. Marching was great. Marching was fantastic in the 60s. It is possible that today we need entirely different approaches. Marching, you can't just say it's no longer useful. It is useful, but it is also to be seen as part of an arsenal. What are the other elements? That's what we have to discuss, what we have to create. We have to create all kinds of ways to address a problem. I'm so thankful that you called. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That brings us to the end of our program today. Such great interactions. I really, really love this program. If I could just do this every day, oh my gosh, that is a great reward in and of itself. So thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. I see we still had many more people to get online. We'll try and figure a way to get you back online so that you can express yourself. I think it's so important. So coming up next, Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus. You want to stay tuned for that. You can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. As I said, on Monday, you may hear a repeat program instead of my live voice on Monday because the entire station is doing that. So certainly by Tuesday, we'll be back again with each other live. A pleasure always and a great privilege to be in your company. And for those of you observing the holidays, a very happy holiday to you.